Hello and welcome to the Basement Shuffle. I'm Kevin, and with me tonight is Ryan Jewell, drummer extraordinaire, has worked with Chris Forsythe, the Garcia Peoples, Harvey Mandel, Psychedelic Horseshit, Bill McKay, Riley Walker, and Mike Tamboro, just to name a few. This guy's played with a lot of people. Welcome. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, man. Yeah, you've got quite a list of credits, and it's impressive. Harvey Mandel. That's pretty cool. I know that the only thing I really know about him is that he tried out for the Stones for the Black and Blue album, I think. And then he played with Canned Heat for quite a while, I think, right?
Right, yeah. And he told me his second or third gig with Canned Heat was Woodstock.
Oh,
so
wow.
So that was like, it was like pretty much went on full on.
Right away. Right into the fire. Cool, man.
Yeah. But he's great. He's amazing, innovative guitar player and a really sweet guy. And yeah, he's incredible.
I saw you with Riley Walker. I think I saw you back in November at the 9:30 Club opening for Dinosaur Jr.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, man, I liked it a lot. I'd listened to a couple of songs off of that. I don't think it's the latest Riley Walker record anymore, but I liked it, and it was even better live. You guys were great. I was
And 9:30 Club is one of my favorite sounding rooms listen to music or to play it. Yeah, it always sounds incredible in there. Like as being a music nerd. I don't know if I'm a music nerd, but I'm a music playing nerd, and I like it always feels like it's pretty, I don't want to say easy to play in that room, but like for a decent sized room, it always just sounds great. It feels like, yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I've never played there, seen many a show there. But it does sound good. I think the best show I saw sound wise was David Byrne. Sounded perfect, man. It was so good. He had a little string section with him. And maybe some horns. And it was really good.
Was it in 9:30 Club?
At 9:30, yeah. This was early 2000s. I think it was.
Have seen that same tour.
The Feelings tour. It was. It was for that record, Feelings, I think.
Yeah, which was an awesome record.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I saw him. Maybe close to. I saw right around. It was. I guess. Feelings came out like maybe 2 or 3 years before this, but
yeah,
right after, yeah.
Now that I think about it, it was that one. Look Into the Eyeball, right?
Oh yeah, right. I remember that. And it was. I remember I saw him like 2 days after 9/11. It was crazy, and it was still, it was still like no fly zone kind of thing. It was like a weird, really weird times. And I remember he closed the set or near the end, played Life During Wartime, and it was like, yeah, it was wild. It was a really weird. Weird vibe. It was cool, but
was that?
But so, one of the best shows I ever saw. So that was like 2001, 21 years ago.
Yeah,
that show's old enough to drink.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, man. But, where was that? Where did you see him?
That was in Ohio. That was in like Columbus, Ohio, a place called the Newport, which used to be the Agora. Is that right?
Yeah, I've heard that name before.
Yeah, but that's like, back in the day, like Neil Young and, Kiss and in the 70s, like everybody came through and played there.
Oh, right. So. Is that where you're from? Ohio?
I'm originally from like Southern Ohio, a little town called Portsmouth, Ohio, which is like right on the Kentucky border, right on the West Virginia border. So it's like super Appalachian.
So you're a hillbilly.
Kind of. Yeah. Right.
Awesome.
Yeah, totally.
Cool.
There's little bits of the accent still come through, but it's pretty like mellowed out, kind of Midwest, you know.
Yeah. Now that you mention it, yeah, I can kind of pick up on a slight twang, but yeah.
I still say y'all all the time. That's the one that really has stuck around. But
yeah, well, yeah. I'm in Southern Maryland, and I think Maryland is kind of on the Mason-Dixon line, and so
right.
Yeah, we say y'all too. I think that's the cutoff. Like right. Delaware and above, they stop saying y'all or something like that.
Okay, yeah. Right. Well, anyway, yeah, we were talking about David Byrne. But,
oh, yes.
But, yeah, so, yeah, some of it. Oh, because the 930 Club sounds so good, and then David, right, I'm backtracking. Yeah. And, yeah, that band, as far as, like, playing with Riley and all those guys are great. Yeah, that was with I think Bill McKay was on that one, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And Scott Kohlberg was on bass. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very cool.
I was right up front for that show, and
yeah,
yeah. It looked like Bill McKay had running shoes on. Is he a runner?
He's just got cool stuff. He's actually, I don't see him. Maybe he's a runner. He definitely wears cool shoes.
Hmm. Okay.
He's cool. He's a total badass.
Oh, absolutely. On the guitar. Yeah. I know that.
Yeah. He's like, he's from Pittsburgh, and I sometimes, or I guess my wife or I, or we both kind of say he's kind of like, he's almost like the Mr. Rogers of music or something. He's just so, there's, I don't know if there's something about Pittsburgh or just like, he's just such a special human.
Well,
that it's just like, yeah.
Wow, like he has like this sort of demeanor of Mr. Rogers, or
just that kind of like overwhelming like positivity, and but like a really good sense of humor. He's just like the, not, you know, just super nice,
good dude,
and yeah, good dude, yeah.
Cool. Tall drink of water too.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, and then you got Riley Walker. He seems like,
yeah,
he seems like a fun guy.
Yeah,
I can tell. Yeah. His sense of humor comes through a lot in the stuff that I've seen. I think the last thing I watched was like he was demonstrating how he likes to mic up acoustics on a reverb video or something.
Oh, like, yeah, yeah, right.
Now, for me personally, it doesn't matter about left or right. They're all blended. It just matters that I get two signals from these two pickups through my sweet little Ernie Ball stereo volume pedal into this Cathedral Stereo Reverb by Electro Harmonix. And these two signals, this is where the mother of it all comes. Oh my God, pay attention now. Goes to either of these radial tone bones, which are acoustic guitar preamps. They're a fine Canadian company. And this is a side note, these things are built like tanks. And the amount of range these babies have, holy smokes, I gotta tell you. Look at this. 4-band EQ on here and a 4-band EQ on here. All right, enough with that jargon. Let's get down to it.
But yeah, that seemed like a fun group that you were in. Who's on bass on that one?
That was Scott Kohlberg on that tour. So he does it sometimes, and then Andrew Young does it a lot. Andrew Scott Young.
Okay.
Who, and I originally met Andrew through, or sorry, I originally met Riley through Andrew. I knew, and so we kind of like all have some like free jazz, experimental, improv kind of noise background, along with other things too. That's one cool thing about actually, yeah, playing specifically with Riley and, you know, the musicians that kind of he gets together to play, are that there's usually kind of like an overlap of a couple of different backgrounds, or kind of like there's some like song, like singer-songwriter background, and some jazz or free jazz or like experimental improv kind of thing. Yeah, and so like for me, it's really fun because I get to kind of wear different hats at different moments, and that's kind of how, yeah. So Andrew, that often like we're going out in a couple weeks. And that'll be kind of a trio of, yeah, Riley, Andrew, and me. But I've known both Andrew and Riley for like 10 or 15 years now, something like that.
Okay.
And it was originally through like, cause I knew Andrew was this kind of great, like free jazz bass player, upright player. And then, I was going to play a gig and, you know, invited Andrew to do it. And he's like, hey, I know this kid who like just totally like shreds on guitar. He's got like an SG electric guitar. And he's like, you know, he was like 19 at the time or something.
Yeah.
And he's like, he kind of sounds like Sonny Chirac and Derek Bailey, you know, it's like this kind of real out free jazz guitar thing. I was like, cool, let's try it. And we played and it was awesome. And then, yeah, after that, I mean, it was like, he kind of went through these different phases of like, cause I first knew him as like, Riley, that is, as like this kind of experimental, you know, Derek Bailey guitar guy. And then like a year or two later, it was like, oh, he's doing this Fahey thing. That's like spot, you know, I don't say spot on, everyone's got their own take on it, but it was doing this kind of finger style acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
I don't know if your listeners know Fahey, John Fahey. I don't know what. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever. If they know David Byrne, they'll know. Yeah. But he was doing that thing. And then like a year or two later, I heard him open his mouth and like sing. And I was like, oh, okay, you got this thing going on.
Yeah.
And then, and then at the time it was still kind of more early British folk sort of vibe, which he's kind of like, oh, that's, you know, that's old news now. You know, it's like, it's all like evolution over time. Like we all like, I mean, I did it. I still do. I'd like imitate your heroes for a while to find a voice. And then once you kind of find your voice, you sort of shed that, you know, cocoon or whatever. Like,
yeah,
it's like
bring it into your own sound.
Right. Totally. Yeah.
It's like copying it. Yeah.
Right. It's like an incubation thing to absorb. And then you kind of emerge out of it. But, yeah, and then every record I think he does just sounds, I think, just gets kind of better and better because it becomes more of its own thing. And it's, you know, yeah, but he's always keeps, you know, like I think he did, you know, two or three records last year and they were all kind of different. You know, there was like the song record that was at Course and Fable that played on. Then there was.
Yeah, that's the record I was thinking of. Yeah. Then what the newest thing I see is what post Wook.
Oh yeah.
Aren't you on that too?
Yeah, yeah. That's Andrew and Riley and me, and that came about. There was like supposed to play, what was it? There was like some tour that got canceled for COVID and Andrew's flight was already booked. So it was like the flight was already there. He was like, well, Andrew's gonna be here, we might as well like do something. So we booked time at Dreamland Studio, which is this like, I was super excited because it's really close to where I live.
Yeah,
it's just down the road in Woodstock, and then, it's this cool. It's this old church space, and it's like a cool studio where a bunch of records have been done for several decades. And Jerry Murata owns it now, who's one of my favorite drummers. So it was very cool to like be in that space.
Yeah, yeah. I think Sonic Youth has done a record at Dreamland, and like I don't know if Dinosaur did or not, but I've definitely heard of that studio.
I'd have to go back and look. I just remember what is it, Cosmic Thing, the, you know, B-52s, Love Shack was done in that room.
But
the big one for me, there are these Suzanne Vega records, because I'm such a, I mean, definitely for like, you know, good songwriting and stuff, but like I'm such a like drumming nerd and like recording kind of production nerd that there were like there are a couple of these Suzanne Vega records that are like, it's like Mitchell Froom and Chad Blake like doing arrangements and engineering, and Jerry Murata playing weird drums on them, that were like, growing up, those were always like inspiring from a drum recording type thing. So it was cool to like be in, you know, I was like hanging out with Jerry Murata, and I was like, so you did that record here? And he's like, yeah. I was like, which room? He was like, oh, we did, you know, we did it in this room here. And it was just like, it's like, you know, the stuff you can't, like, no matter how much you like try to geek out on the internet and read whatever, just to like sit and talk with a guy and be like, oh yeah, this is what we did. We did it over here. We put some mics here. You know, it was just like, those kinds of experiences you just can't, you know, there's no other way to have. I don't know. It's just amazing.
Yeah, that's like, awesome, man.
I mean, for most people, they wouldn't care. But for a nerd like me that's so into that kind of stuff, there's just like...
I get it.
Yeah, I'm
the same way. I got to go to Inner Ear Studios in Arlington. Yeah. And Yeah, I wanted to ask 1,000 questions, but he was kind of working. Don was working at the time, so I was like, oh, man.
Yeah.
But I did bring my Flex Your Head record and had him sign it while Jeff Nelson just happened to drop by. And I got him to sign it too, and they were freaked out. They were like, who is this guy that brought like Flex Your Head record?
Yeah,
it's just like, you know, I just carry it in my car, guys. You know, totally.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
but yeah,
so I used to prop the hood open, right?
Yeah, like yeah, you know,
change the oil. Yeah,
yeah. But back to the Suzanne Vega records. Which ones are you talking about? The only thing I know by her is like, Jesus, I just blanked. What is some thing about a diner? What, I just know the hits.
Oh yeah, the Tom Stutt. Yeah, that's the song that was about the Seinfeld diner.
Oh really?
It's like, yeah, it's that same place. It's the, I mean, it's called Tom. What is it called? Tom's Restaurant, I think is the name of it.
Oh, okay.
It's cool. In, yeah.
I didn't know.
But yeah, anytime you see the big salad, like the place in Seinfeld where the diner, I mean, the external shots, it's not the actual, yeah.
Yeah.
But that's the place where that's, yeah.
Oh, no kidding. But yeah, I understand that she was, she kind of pushed the envelope as far as sound, her sound, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
She had that one hit, maybe another hit. But, like, I understand that her albums are kind of disparate sound-wise. So which ones were you talking about?
The big one for me, there was this one called 99.9 Degrees. And that was the one where, again, a lot of it was, like, Jerry Marotta was doing, not always just playing drums, but, you know, he would have set up odd percussion drum sets, you know. And I'm as a drummer, and this is getting deep into, like, the nerdy drummerness side of you know, my interests or whatever, but like, yeah, I've always been into, you know, like, I like Jim Keltner, I like Milford Graves, I like Jerry Marotta, I like a lot of these, Matt Chamberlain, all of these drummers that, like, it's not always just kicks, you know, it's not always just a regular drum set. It's like you can still, it's not overplaying ever. It's not like, it's super musical. It's like, it's thinking of the drums as a musical instrument, like a novel idea, you know. Wow. it's like part of the on that record and some others, it was a combination of I like the way that Jerry plays a lot. He's got a great feel and really great sense of sound, and that fits the song. And then you know, a big part of it was this engineer named Chad Blake, who was kind of like, did a lot of stuff. It was kind of like famous for like using weird, one of the earliest people to do it, but like in a time coming out of the 80s and into the 90s when, you know, it was like super hi-fi, super pristine, like, you know, these like Hugh Padgham Sting records and stuff, like the sound of the 80s. And then like, and then there were like big sound, there were like big room sounds, like, you know, all the stuff like Albini was doing and that kind of thing, where there was like, you know, there was that big rock, kind of a big rock grunge sound too thing, whatever, grunge in quotes for lack of a better, whatever, right. But like that thing. But there, this was kind of a cool, kind of intimate, low, like close-ish mics, but they're all kind of like distorted and messed up. And yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I've watched his, one of his videos on YouTube as well. I think he has a kind of a series of how to like mic different stuff, like how to mic a snare and how to mic a guitar cabinet and stuff like that. And he's got a very original way of thinking about recording. What was he known for? Was that Pearl Jam? Well, who did he work with that was big?
Which, for who? The engineer?
Chad
Blake?
Yeah.
A bunch of stuff. There was a Los Lobos record that was like kind of turned some heads sonically, and then he's done it. I mean, he's like, whatever, his credits are like crazy, like, you know, kind of more recently like Black Keys records and stuff, you know.
Right, but he kind of made his name in the 90s with like grunge and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's all kinds of cool stuff. And for me, it was cool too. Also, like, I have this like, I used to make a lot of tape music, like Musique Concrète, still do a bit, but now it's often more like part of other stuff. But like, I mean, for several years, I was kind of like, I went really deep into all that. I was into like, you know, all this, kind of like early electronic tape music, recording sounds and splicing tape and, you know, stretching it and all that like texture that comes along with it. So for me, it was like a music, it was like using, an instrument as the, like the record, the whole recording process is part of the process. You're, and sometimes it all depends on context, but sometimes you're getting this pristine, not even pristine. It's always going through a lens, you know, it's like photography. It's like sometimes,
Yeah, if it's going through a microphone, it's being treated.
Already. Right.
Yeah.
Even as transparent as it, there's still mic plate, there's still everything. So, anyway, like all coming full circle. It was very cool to record in that in Dreamland and talk to Jerry Marotta. That was a cool experience for me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, being you know kind of a because I kind of look at, I think about like things that I do now on a daily basis. I'm like, so much of it started with something, you know, some record I heard as a teenager or something that like, you know, cause I guess as I was practicing drums, I was like really like, you know, just short of saying obsessed with like trying to get a good sound. I was like, I would listen to someone and be like, why does this sound good? And why does this not sound good?
Right.
And I was like, it's all this, it's simple. Like everyone's playing the same simple beat or something, you know, but why does this, you know, and it was for the longest time, it, for me, it was all about just like touch and balance and tone, like just all in the hands kind of thing. Like you don't need, but then as time goes on, and that's still, that is still like, I think 90% of it. But then there's all, also this other thing where, you know, through the years, and I also started getting into like really just getting to record a lot. I mean, I was like, I was very fortunate to be able to record at a relatively young age and then just keep doing it pretty often. And so every time I'd go in the studio, first of all, I loved going in the studio just as much, if not more than playing live.
Right.
And then I would always get so excited. I'm like, all right, we get to like play in the lab, you know, it was like, the same way I was like, you know, manipulating tape and like, you know, working with sound that way. So to me, it was like the combination of all these things. And then I would just get to like pick engineers' brains, like, constantly. Like I would just be asking, probably obnoxiously asking so many questions, like, okay, what are you doing there? What's that? Okay. Okay. You're okay. I see. Okay. So you're cutting out 240 here and you're boosting 5K. Okay, cool. Gotcha. Yeah. You know, it's like all this like little things that just,
So you worked at a studio?
No, I've just been.
So just if you were recording with a band.
The other side of the glass. Yeah.
You would just bother the engineer while he was mixing your music. Cool.
Yeah. Or tracking, or I'd be like, why are you putting that mic there and not over here? You know, why is it, you know, just.
Yeah.
So when I was like, so I grew up in Southern Ohio, and when I was maybe like 45 minutes or an hour north of where I grew up, there was this recording studio school called Recording Workshop in Massieville, Ohio. It's very just north of Waverly, Ohio. It's like, you know, it's a pretty small recording school, but like they would kind of outsource things from the universities in the state. They would send, like, if someone was doing a recording, you know, or some kind of, you know, music degree thing, they would send people there because there was an actual like recording studio, and you could, or you could also go and just get like a certificate thing. I never did it actually, but it was like, you know, learn how to, kind of like full, like a small version of Full Sail or one of those sort of things. And I was really lucky because that was there, and bands, they needed bands to record all the time and just to have things to practice, you know what I mean? Like to, so I was really lucky. Like I'd only been playing for like, you know, a couple years or something. And I don't remember how it actually started, but started going up there like a couple times a month. Just with my like high school band, like my high school, like garage band. And it was great. And that, you know, we'd like, I was like, here I am, I'm like 16 or something, and I'd go in and play, and I'd be like, why does that bass drum sound like shit? And they'd be like, well, because you are playing like shit, you know? It's like,
because you tune like shit.
Yeah, you tune like shit, and I was like, what are all those, you know, they'd solo out. I'd never heard, because you're playing, you know, you're like playing in your bedroom, you're playing in your garage, and you're just like, you never hear the little, I was like, what is, what's that, what are those extra little dribbles on the bass drum? And they're like, well, your beater, when you put your foot down, it's bouncing on the drum. I was like, that sounds terrible. And they're like, yeah, it kind of does. Yeah. I was like, is there anything you can do about it? And they're like, not really. I mean, we can try to gate it, but it's probably going to sound like shit because you can't gate that, you know. Yeah. Anyway, not to get into all the technical stuff, but like, they basically were like, you know, if you, they're like, yeah, that's what you're doing, you know. And then I was like, oh, maybe I should not. So then I, you know, for the next week, I'd practice nothing but bass drum, and I'm like making sure I get this big full tone and the, you know, whatever, getting the beater off the head.
Yeah.
So little things like that. Yeah.
I just learned how to do that recently.
Yeah, right. So
bury the beater a little more instead of letting it bounce. Yeah, it took me a while.
Yeah. Also, so I ended up doing the opposite. I was like getting it off, so I let the head get the full, you know, let the head move basically. Let it move some air and some breathe for a second.
Okay.
It's weird if you AB it, if you leave it on, you often end up. I mean, it's like with a drumstick. You know, if you leave a stick on the floor tom,
you're also muting it.
You're muting it, right? So, so usually not. I mean, sometimes there are weird things that happen, you know, acoustically. But I would say 99% of the time, bringing the beater off of the head gets you. You even with a muffled drum, even if you have a decent amount of like muffling, you know, on the drum head, it's still because you're letting the center or close to the center. Whatever, we're getting into like physics and we're getting real, you know, this is like, anyone listening to this is like, okay, I'm
just, well, the drummers good in the audience will dig it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
leaving, even with a muffled drum, if you want some of that extra bottom, you know, bring the beater off will, let it,
yeah,
let those lower frequencies kind of like actually
you get the body of the drum more. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And then if it's an open tuned drum, like I've, you know, played a bunch of jazz stuff, or often just sometimes tune that way, it's definitely a huge difference there because you can actually get the length of the note.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So did you get to hang with Dinosaur?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, they're cool. Yeah. And I'd met him. So, there's this guy John Maloney who's done a bunch of stuff. But he played in this band Sunburned, Hand of the Man.
Mm-hmm.
He did stuff in Thurston Moore's band for a long time. He's awesome. He's like Massachusetts guy. He's their tour manager. I've known Maloney for many years. So even before this tour, I've probably seen Dinosaur Jr. I don't know, a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Kind of hung out and, you know, which is awesome. It's super cool. Cause they're also this like kind of, you know, they're legends. I mean, in my mind, they're like, they're awesome. Oh, all absolutely. Of them, all three of them. They're like, yeah.
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 Virtual.
I mean, I was into Folk Implosion and stuff too. So I'm, you know, into Lou.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. The whole, yeah.
Sabado and yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
If Murph had a solo project, I'd probably listen to that.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
But, yeah, man, that's cool.
Yeah. And it's cool to hear them. Like, to me, they're sounding better than I've ever heard them. Which I mean, you know, I didn't see them in the '80s or anything, but like they, every year that I see them, they sound better. They're kind of like one of those bands where it's like they've got like this looseness. They just gel. You know, it's like, it's kind of that like thing you can't really, it's hard to describe and hard to.
Yeah, you can't practice it. It just happens.
Yeah.
It just, you know, you have that chemistry with people in a band.
And right.
It just works.
Right.
Yeah, I get it. I wish they would play more off of like albums beyond Green Mind. Like, I think they play Wagon off of Green Mind, and that's it. But they never play anything off of, like, Where You Been or, you know, Hand It Over or anything like that.
Yeah.
I don't know if Lou just doesn't want to learn the bass lines or what.
Yeah, I don't know. I never thought about that, actually. Yeah, like, what, yeah. Or how, where the set list even. Some of it, I mean, from tour to tour, there's some staples, and then there's some mixed in things and some new things. And,
yeah.
But they play different. I mean, they play. It's cool too. They definitely are feeding off of the energy of the room too. Like there were some of the shows where we're like, you know, yeah, it's cool. Like, you know, crowd surfing and, you know, stage diving, and it was like kind of awesome.
On this tour?
Yeah, yeah, there were a couple. Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah, and then yeah, it was cool.
Well, you know what? I'm not that surprised. At 9:30, a little mosh pit broke out.
Yeah, right.
I was like, what the hell's going on? I'm 44.
Yeah.
Stop it. I'm trying to watch the music.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the solos are different. Like, yeah, it's just cool to hear how they do that, you know? And it's just like, yeah. Such a super unique style. Super unique.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's kind of one of the ultimate things of like, you know, if you can, if someone can hear you and say like, oh, I know who that is, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That's
an achievement.
That's something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the wildest show on that tour?
Where
was the stage diving happening?
I remember Atlanta being like really rowdy.
No kidding.
Yeah. Like, yeah, just like, I mean, kind of like, yeah, just a really rowdy, like in a good way, like not like,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
but
people
just, you
are
know,
probably
people, like, yelling back, you know, to the stage and like, yeah. You know, just people were excited. I think, yeah, people were just excited to, it was kind of this weird pocket of where, you know, there were like big indoor shows. And I think people were kind of pent up from it and were like, cool, okay, everything's cool now. And yeah. Then like Omicron, you know, it's coming in, whatever. But like, you know, there was this kind of like this window of like.
Yeah.
So I think it was some of that pent up energy where people were like ready to have a big rock and big loud rock and roll show.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that was fun as the band on stage to see that.
Yeah.
You know. Wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
It was a fun tour too, because they're like, you know, Dinosaur's like notoriously one of the loudest bands still in, you know, in rock. And then
Absolutely. And then
we're like, I don't know, we were not. You know, we were like sort of jazzy.
Yeah,
sort
you
of
got
jazzy proggy.
Quiet parts and stuff. Yeah.
We like have moments, but it's tricky to like, you can't.
Well, let me ask you, how does that happen? How do you get on a tour like that? Does Jay like Riley Walker and he's like, yeah, let me get him on the tour? Or is it more like managers, you know, put something together? Or how does that happen?
I think that they needed someone for the tour, and they were kind of like, I don't know, actually. I'm not sure who, yeah. But we're kind of like, yeah, in circles where we kind of are aware of each other, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it was probably in a discussion of like a couple, yeah. Options, and that was like, oh yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah, fantastic. I thought it was a good fit.
I mean, it's the kind of thing I would like to see, but I know, you know, a lot of people were more. I'm sure a lot of people like hated it. Mostly though, people seemed really into it.
Yeah, I think you guys had a good reception. I dug it, of course.
Yeah.
It fits because, you know, it's two guitar bands, guitar bands, and it just works, man.
Right.
Yeah, and you guys sounded fantastic.
Awesome, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Man, what have you been working on lately? Like, what have you been working on this week? Because I know you're busy, man. You do a lot of stuff.
Yeah. What have I been doing this week? I guess probably the main thing. There's a like a short film soundtrack that I've been like kind of co-writing. John Dietrich from Deerhoof.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yes, the drummer. Yeah, uh-huh.
Or guitar guy. He's a guitar guy, yeah.
Oh, is he? I'm sorry.
Yeah. And so he's, yeah, it's...
So what can you tell me about it as far as the soundtrack? Like, is it just kind of ambient? Is it...
No, it's cool. It's a cool, this guy, Steven Torselli, and it's a cool film. It's like, I don't know how much I can say about it actually, but like, it's a cool vibe where it's like, it's a little bit funny. It's a little bit dark. It's like kind of, you know, it's got a cool moods to set. And then, you know, so it's fun. Done like a little bit of things, you know, with film before, but this, yeah, been doing more lately, you know, the past like year or so. So it's cool. It's a fun way to write that's different than writing, you know, a song, you know, for yourself. Or like I've written like songs, you know, for like, you know, bands that I'm in or whatever. There's like a Mosses project that I do and a few other things that, yeah. What's and that? Then
you said Mosses?
Yeah, that's the thing that, yeah. Band? Yeah, that's the thing that Danette, my wife and I do. And then there's, you know, I was like, you know, written for like, I had this quintet for a while and that was like kind of weird chamber music. It was like somewhere between like jazz thing in quotes and like chamber music and then like kind of weird like 20th century text scores, you know, weird abstract. So it was like a combination. It was very, very like, I would say kind of Braxton influence or something. So there was that sort of writing.
Braxton?
Yeah, Anthony Braxton. Like that was like
that's what I was
touch.
Thinking about. Yeah. Yeah. The saxophone player.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. Right. But not, I mean, not like directly, you know, if I had to like say, because just in it being like a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B, and a little bit of column C.
Sure.
Because there were some pieces that sounded like, you know, like an Ornette tune or something, and there were some things that sounded like, you know, Helmut Lachmann or like these weird, like, you know, Stockhausen or something. It was like kind of pretty varied. Anyway, so I've done like a bunch, and then I've done lots of like concrete things, and I'm frequently writing. Like years ago, I had lessons, and someone was like, "Yeah, just write every day, right? You know, even if you don't use it, just make big folders or big,
that's,
you know, piles."
That seems to be the secret, man.
Yeah.
Well, I guess there is no secret. You just have to do the work.
Yeah.
Which is such a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
But that's how you got to do it.
Yeah, totally. And so then if you have, I mean, it's like, but for this, I didn't use any of those folders, but it is like a muscle that you practice. So then I can just sort of sit down and like write something. It's not always good, but like, you know, it starts a process. And so, but yeah, writing for film, it's, you know, there's some other things that you have to consider. And it's in a sense, I mean, we all know like a classic example, if you have like the same scene and you put four different pieces of music on it, it completely alters the scene. You know, if you have, you know, the Jaws theme, or you have the Benny Hill theme, they're very different. Yeah, you know, like they're very different pieces of music.
Yeah. Are you watching the film as you compose?
Yeah, that's right. And then a lot of just revisions, you know, just like constantly, like, you know, and then try this, and we're kind of sending things back and forth.
Cool. John.
Yeah, yeah. So he'll, you know, he's got they're like, you know, about half of the kind of base, you know, the kind of the start of each thing is kind of like mostly led by one of us or the other, but it's completely collaborative, so it's great. He's a, you know, super, super smart, super creative person.
Yeah, and I'm guessing both of you are multi-instrumental. You guys play a lot of different stuff, yeah.
Right. Like, most of the stuff I did kind of like, you know, a MIDI, you know, rough version of something, and then some of it, you know, be like replaced with, you know, a real instrument or, you know, yeah.
Is there an instrument that you're finding that you're writing more on for this? Like, are you writing it on piano mostly? Are you writing on guitar mostly? Or is it different every time for this movie?
Because, yeah, for this, I mean, it's different for everything, but for this specifically, like, to keep it, you know, focused, it was I mostly wrote it on keys. Yeah.
Okay.
For the stuff I was doing.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, John Scott, you know.
And then he's just
a great guitar player.
He's adding guitar to your keyboard stuff?
Well, it's weird. We're kind of both, neither of us are thinking, I can't really like speak for him, but I know for myself, and I think for him too, neither of us are really thinking like specifically about an instrument.
Sure.
Any more than it, except for just like in the way that you would arrange something that like, okay, it's like another, yeah. It's not like,
tells you what it needs. Is that
kind of, or the film does.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Right on.
Yeah, totally. It's like, it's not, yeah. Like, what was that Jim Jarmusch movie with the Neil Young soundtrack?
Dead Man?
Dead Man, yeah, that's yeah. right, yeah. So it's not like that where we're like, oh, I've got an instrument, I'm going to, like, you know, kind of stick to, which that was, I mean, that was great. That sounded great. That was brilliant,
too.
That
was cool.
So many different options, yeah.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. I love it. I'd love to do more of it. It's like,
yeah, that sounds
very
cool.
Rewarding. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to try that. And plus you kind of have a deadline. You kind of have,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Does that make you work differently?
Yeah. Kind of. Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I think in general,
instead of like, if you're writing stuff for yourself, like a band that you're in, you kind of have unlimited time to kind of finish it. You know, you
right.
could work on something that you had 20 years ago and finish it today or right. something like that. But with this, it's like you got to have it done by now.
Yeah, right. Really. Yeah, I think back to like Bach, like had the same thing. It's so funny. It was like, whatever, it was like hundreds of years ago. He was like, oh, I need to write another, you know, chorale for this mass or whatever. Like, and just write the most amazing things. But it's like, that's how he got so formulaic in a way. It was that he just had these weekly deadlines to like write a ton of music.
Yeah.
And kind of invented like so much stuff that we just kind of say take for granted. But like, yeah. So, yeah, deadlines can be good in a way. Like, I wonder, yeah, if he, like, I don't know if Bach would have been Bach if he didn't have, you know, a weekly deadline of like,
right.
Like, maybe he would have went, like, I don't know, maybe had a hobby or something. You know, maybe he would have, like...
just picked whatever. Up woodworking.
Yeah, right. Like, I don't know if he would have written, like, you know, hundreds of pieces of music mm-hmm. If he wasn't, like...
He had to.
On yeah. salary, yeah, right. to, like, do it, yeah. So...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a different... I mean, it can be... Yeah, it's weird. I'm so, like... I feel like every... I feel like there's no right or wrong way to do anything in some ways, as far as like with the creative process, because there's so many, you get different results, but they're all, yeah, everyone's got a different. I mean, in some ways, having no deadline and completely, you know, be like, oh, like, well, you know, there are these like D'Angelo records that he spends like 5 to 10 years on, and they're all like totally brilliant.
Yeah,
and then there are other things that are like. Well, then there's also, what was it, Chinese Democracy? That was like, not
Guns N' Roses.
That was 20 yeah. years. Yeah. 20 years, and it was not, wasn't the best, but
no.
whatever. But, yeah, but yeah, there is something about like the urgency of like, okay, you got to finish it. You know, there's, what was it? There's, one of those, solo John Lennon albums. I think it's, maybe it was, is it Merry Christmas War is Over? One of those, it was like they tracked it and then they did a rough mix that night and then they like I think they just printed it to tape because mm-hmm. they couldn't have, or maybe they didn't acetate, but they had it on the radio the next day. It
oh,
was like
yeah.
and then they kept that mix. That was the mix too. That is like they didn't ever, and I think that there's like a Whitney Houston thing too that's also a rough mix.
Yeah.
That they like just they're like, yeah, it's pretty good. It's fine. You know, it's like it's weird. Like sometimes you think these things. Yeah. Sometimes you think spending more time is always better, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's not. But then the inverse is totally true, too. There are definitely things that are rushed, and they sound rushed, and they kind of sound terrible. You know, it's like okay, you've got 45 seconds to write a song and record it, and you know, it's like probably not going to be the best. I'm going to write a song about, like, I don't know,
yeah.
eating carrots and, I don't know, something stupid. Like,
yeah. Oh, so you, like the Beach Boys.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the vegetable song.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds great.
I can't, I mean, it's
Smile.
Like, I don't like hearing people chew. That's my least favorite song on that album. But
it's Paul McCartney, right? Isn't Paul McCartney, isn't
yeah,
he like
him
doing,
and Linda yeah. are like munching on That's celery right. or something. Yeah.
That's right. Oh, man.
But yeah, yeah. I hear what you're saying. Yeah, sometimes you can't beat the original like demo.
Yeah,
and I think, what was it, you know, you were talking about those artists that, like, recorded it that night and it was released on the radio the next day. What was it? I think it was Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young with Ohio.
Oh, yeah.
I think
that makes sense.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, they saw what happened at Kent State and they, you know, they're like, oh, we got to record this song now and then
yeah.
we got to get it out the next day so the people can hear it, man.
Right. Yeah, you can't wait. It's not, like, relevant, like... a year later.
Yeah, right.
That's one reason I've kind of avoided writing like very political songs or anything, because it's often, I mean, I love the, you know, the idea, but it often, it can be like, it goes so quickly, it's already dated. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's tricky. You almost have to, put it in a more timeless way or something. Not that I've ever done that, but like, that's the stuff that really sticks, you know. The bigger picture issues and things like that.
Right. Yeah. So how long do you have for that movie? When is the deadline?
There's not a clear deadline. They just want to have it, you know, soon so they can make, schedule things. It's kind of like, it's weird how it's very similar to a band and a record and a tour, because there are like film festivals and things that you submit to. And so that's kind of how that world works. And it's, you know, it's, which is kind of sort of similar in a way. It's like, oh, okay, if you're in a band and you're like, okay, we should have a new, you know, try to have a new record out at this time so that, you know, the summer festival season, you can get on some of those and do the, you know. Yeah. So it's, and you can think about that or not, but it's, you know, there are times where it's, I honestly don't really think about that stuff very often, but the band, you know, but artists that I work with do, because it's, they sort of have to more, you know.
Yeah.
Just for scheduling and booking things. It kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
You said you still do tape music every once in a while. I saw this thing yesterday. It was a Mellotron made out of a Walkman. Have you seen this?
Oh, no, but I've thought about, trying to find ways to do that. Cause it would be, I used to use a lot of like cassette loops. Uh-huh. And things, and I've been not saying like, oh, I had that idea, but like, yeah, it's not in some ways, and you know the 10cc story too, for
yes
that's kind of like us, you know, this like tape loops of vocals that you sort of just mix on the board,
right? You're so, playing the board as an instrument.
So I've definitely thought of like, oh yeah, if you just had tape loops of different pitches, you could play them back. But to put it, was it like in a keyboard form that you could play it live? Like,
well, it's sold as a kit that you that you can solder to a Walkman somehow, and what it has is
variable speed. I bet
it definitely has a bunch of knobs.
Yeah,
and then I want to say, I don't think it's like a chromatic keyboard on it, but it certainly has some kind of buttons. I saw it last night. I didn't really. It was at work, and I was closing time, and I didn't get to research it, but I was like, this is freaking cool.
Yeah, that's cool. I bet what that is a tape loop of one tone, and then I bet it has like kind of a potentiometer, like slow down the motor, essentially.
Huh.
I bet. And I bet if you slow it down, you know, a certain percentage, then you'll get certain musical intervals. I could be completely wrong, but that would be a not super difficult way to do it, because otherwise, I mean, like on an actual Mellotron, you have strips of tape, but you have whatever 50 of them, you know, or something, which is like a major undertaking.
Yeah, I'll send you a link.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I'd love to. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Well, it looks like we're getting down to it.
Yeah.
What type of shoes do you like to wear when you're not playing drums?
I don't know. What do I have? I have some kind of LL Bean. I just wear the same shoes all the time. So,
actually, that
was a conscious thing. That's actually a funny question, because I last time when I got shoes, I had to think about like when I go on tour, I want shoes that I can wear, like, because sometimes you're like in cold weather and sometimes you're in hot weather.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you're walking around cities and sometimes you're walking around a desert and sometimes you're walking around, you know, forests or whatever, and then also playing drums. So I don't like to have to, didn't want to have to like carry extra shoes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like to try to find something that was versatile. So yeah, I ended up getting these, like, I don't know what they are. They're like not quite a, they're like a low cut boot from LL Bean.
Come on, let's see them.
Kind of an all purpose. Yeah. This is like an ad for shoes, but yeah. So they're like, they're not too heavy, but they're like sturdy enough. you know.
It's like a desert boot, but it has a moccasin toe. Very stylish. Very nice.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't even know. But it's sturdy, and it's not, it's like, it feels it feels weather ready, but also, you know, light enough that it's not like you know, I don't like heavy. I often play barefoot a lot of times, even.
Yeah.
But regular shoes. I used to wear Chuck Taylors all the time. Those were like my drumming shoes and all kinds of things. It kind of doesn't matter that much, though, honestly. Like, when I was like 15, I saw Peter Criss play with on a Kiss reunion, and I was like, he was playing in the boots, man.
No way.
I think he was playing in the boots. Maybe I'm wrong, but I
want to believe it, but I can't believe it. There's no way, man. They're like knee-high boots.
Yeah.
How do you do that? I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah.
I'm going to have to research that. Which tour did you see?
What was it? Like probably 97 or 8 or something like that?
Oh, right on.
It was one of those reunion things, and I was like, I was in high school, and I went, my parents were Kiss fans, so they like... It was awesome. It was super cool. But like, I remember it was in Charleston, West Virginia, and
oh yeah, saw Lollapalooza there.
Oh really? That's cool. That's awesome. Which year?
I went 93 and 96.
Cool.
I think the latest one was the one with Sonic Youth as a headliner. I think that was 96.
Ah, nice.
Anyway.
Yeah.
That's cool. Long story short, so I went to this thing, and then I think it was on like a Friday or something. I didn't go to school that, or I can't remember what it was, but like, I told my friends like, oh, going to this concert. And they're like, okay, cool. You know, like, tell us how it went. And then I got back, and like that weekend or something, I got mono, and I like didn't, it was like quarantine. I forget how that works even. It's been so long ago. But like, I know I didn't go to school at all that next week. I was like out, and I didn't really talk to anybody. And so the last thing anyone knew was that I went to this Kiss concert, and then I just never came back. So there were all these like, when I came back like a week and a half later, and there were all these like rumors that I had like dropped out of school and like joined the Kiss army and was like painted my face.
Awesome. Yeah.
Like painted my face. Like, yeah. But that did not happen.
Oh man. But. Yeah. Mono, man. Yeah, that was wow. That was COVID before COVID.
Yeah, right. But it was cool. I always tell people that was like you know, the best in the same way that I like seeing I don't know if I've talked about this in other interviews at all or anything, but like I like the idea of seeing very experimental music in large, like, you know, indoor arenas and these like, you know, 20,000 seater places.
Yeah.
Because it's so fascinating to me, because I've seen, you know, you go see like very experimental music, you know, to an audience of 20, you know, in these kind of really small clubs or even house shows and things. But then to see something, so like the Gene Simmons bass solo was this like ridiculous, like, super subs, massive sound system, indoor arena thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, flashing lights, you know, spitting blood.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, it wasn't a bass solo as much as just open strings. They're just rumbling.
Yeah, doesn't he just kind of smack the strings and pose and stuff?
It was a full on noise, you know, it was a noise bass set, you know. Oh. It was like full on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And it was, yeah. And the same thing with seeing, like, you know, I'm always amazed, like, with, you know, with the Grateful Dead played like massive 20,000 seater places, and they would do this drum space thing for, I mean, I can't think of any other band that, you know, plays to audiences that big that has a good 20 to 30 minutes of their set is total freeform noise jam. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, I never thought about that. Like, I've seen clips of the bass solo, because that's like his time to spit blood and like,
yeah, it's more theatrical fire. But like, yeah,
but it is right. Really like a noise show.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Full on.
Yeah,
man, I knew they were cool. I knew they were cool. They, that was actually my first rock band. I'm a Kiss fan, but I did,
yeah,
now I like them even more that I know they're into noise.
Yeah.
Totally. And yeah, I saw the Dead, I think it was 94, and and Bob Dylan. And it was before I really got into those bands, which I regret, man, because I'm sure a lot of cool I'm sure I missed space and drums.
Yeah.
And like trying to look for pot or something like that.
Right.
Whereas,
or just going to the bathroom. It's everyone's bathroom break, but like that's my favorite part. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I wish I could go back now and like check it out, man.
Right.
But yeah, man. Well, it was really cool talking with you.
Yeah.
And
thanks for letting me geek out with whatever. It was a long and winding road.
Yeah.
Of topics. Whatever. Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's kind of what a conversation is like normally if I'm at like, a party or something.
Right. Totally.
That's what I want to talk about, nerdy music stuff.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah. Oh, and I haven't told the audience that the reason I met you is I hired you for lessons.
Oh, and, yeah.
I've only taken one so far, but I look forward to the next one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, man.
And the thing you sent me sounded awesome. Sounded great.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of noise experiments, yeah.
Yeah.
Right on. Thank you. Hey, did you?
Yeah.
I realized today that I mistitled something. I said 1 minute Raven. It was 30 minute Raven. Do you know what that is?
No. And I like, because I knew the drum, you mentioned the drum also waltzes, which is one of my favorite. I mean, I like learned that years ago when it was, yeah, Max Roach's. Yeah, but no, I didn't. And then I was like, well, I'm not Raven. I'm not sure what that, yeah.
Well, it's not strictly drums. It's,
okay.
Oh, God. David Grubbs. David Grubbs playing guitar.
I know David Grubbs.
Of course. Do you know him personally?
Yeah, yeah. I played with him, yeah.
Oh, man. Let me know next time you guys are in the D.C. area. I'd love to check it out.
Yeah, I mean, it was just one thing in New York, but he's another sweetheart. Super cool.
Yeah. But great. This was, it's 30 minutes, and it's him on guitar, John McIntyre on drums.
Yeah.
And I forget, I think.
Recorded a record with him. It's awesome. Yeah, it's all these, like.
Awesome.
Chicago. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that, like the Tortoise and Brokeback and, you know, that whole scene. Oh, Jim O'Rourke. I love those records.
Absolutely. A lot of those, yeah, totally.
But yeah, check that
started
out.
Started me on, yeah.
30-minute Raven, I think you'd really like it. The concept is it's 30 minutes, and they tried to make it sound like it's a continuous piece. Like it starts out with a bass drum pulse, and then it
that makes sense then.
Yeah, see? So
right.
It kind of loops. Check it out.
That's cool, yeah. Maybe I have heard it, because I've been through a bunch of those, right, you know, over the past 25 years, I've been through a bunch of those records. Of that whole orbit of the whole kind of overlap of the Chicago, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, love that stuff. Yeah. So, John McIntyre, was he recording you, or were you playing
music? Yeah, no, he was the recording engineer and mixing engineer for that Riley record from last, the song record, the Course and Fable record.
Yeah.
And which was great, you know, it was up in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
I didn't think about that.
Well, not Maine. It was
not Maine. Yeah, I didn't think about it. I was like, what are the two? Yeah. And that was that was a great time.
Which is where
he's awesome.
Which is where Soma is now. His studio is that in Portland now.
It's I think so. I actually don't, because we did it in this old library space.
Oh, cool.
That's kind of like it's sort of a converted studio now, but it's also like different people do things in there exactly. So it wasn't like his space exactly, but he was engineering it there, which had this big, you know, kind of open, cool, big open room.
What was that called?
It's awful. I can't remember the name of the studio itself, but it was like a convert. If you look up, I don't know.
Converted library.
It's on the. I'm sure it's on the credits of the record. I still have it in front of me.
Sure, I got a couple of buddies that live over
there.
There
was a good bagel place across the street.
Oh, nice. What's that?
Yeah, I don't know, but it was awesome.
Cool.
Yeah.
awesome, man. I think we could do this all night, but we don't have all night. I want to thank you for coming on and doing this.
Thanks for having me, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe we'll do it again.
Anything
you'd want to point people to as far as, you know, anything that you're recording, or maybe you said you might be going out on the road again soon?
Yeah, as of now, it's still scheduled. Opening for Drive-By Truckers on a tour in early February. So it's like coming up pretty soon. For the first gig is at Graceland, which is kind of cool, which I've never been.
Elvis's Graceland?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know they did shows there.
I didn't either. I don't know. I don't know if it's, I assume it's there. I mean, maybe there's like a, I don't know. I've done some of those things where it's like, you think it's the thing and it's actually like a parking lot that's, you know, I mean, but it's still like,
it's like a club like
30 miles
Graceland.
Away. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. But so, I think it is. I think it's somehow.
Wow. Drive-By Truckers. Very cool band. So what band is that that you're in that you're opening for them in?
Oh, that's with that? Riley. That'll be, yeah, oh, that's cool. With, yeah, Riley and then Andrew on bass. So it'll be the post-Wook band, but we'll be doing probably more like Course and Fable songs. But we might do some of the, I don't know.
Without Bill
awesome.
McKay.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Just, yeah, the three piece. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, cool, dude. Thanks a lot. And,
yeah.
And I will talk to you soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Kevin.
See you, man.
Bye.
Scare us. albums, high on the slums of crosstalk ambassadors.
Boomer lives.